This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. During a presidential election, there's rarely more focus on the specific mechanisms of the Electoral College, that long-standing way American states choose the next president. But is the institution itself racist? Does it privilege small and rural states over those with major cities? On this election day, Cato's John Samples details some of the arguments for and against the way Americans choose a president. This is a moment in which people are focused on the election. People are concerned about when we might know who the winner of the election is. And there is this continued, or should say, stronger emphasis right now on the Electoral College as an institution. And from what I've read, a lot of people think that because the Electoral College was instituted, or so the story goes, was instituted in many ways to put up a guardrail to protect the interests of slave-owning states so long ago, that gives us a better reason than we would otherwise have to eliminate it and to replace it with some sort of national popular vote. Just as that story exists, what do you make of that claim?
So the most interesting person on this, the claim is what it is. There's the first question of, you know, the way of electing the president through state electors is a system that doesn't work much like it was designed to. So in many ways, that whole institution has changed a lot on the ground in practical terms. So you have, in a sense, a different institution. So it's become something different, and you can, in other words, it doesn't function the same way to protect even small states, really. So that's one thing. It's a different institution, and it's not the institution it was. But the fact is, when you want to know something like this, you turn to a historian. One of the major historians of this era is a man named Sean Weilance at Princeton University. And he's written a book, which I recommend, on slavery in the Constitution. I recommend it because he's a top historian. He's a progressive person, certainly a man of the left or the center left. And after his book came out, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, where he said, you know, when I wrote the book, I thought the story about the Electoral College was true, that it had been essentially expressed slavery. It was part of that whole system. It was to defend slavery. But here's the following. I thought about it some more and read some more, and here's the considerations that made me change my mind. So we have to stop for a minute and note this. This is a person who had written something, who read more, thought more about it, and changed his mind about it. He changed his mind about it because what he found was, and seemed to be very important information, was that actually the most aggressive slave states actually voted against the Electoral College and the elector system. They did so because, in part, they thought that the electors would be, there was a great fear of kind of democracy and the masses, and they thought electors would be like that. They were looking for someone genuinely independent, they said, and so on. So it's odd that the slave states, the most powerful ones and ones most devoted to the cause, would be voting in the elections against it. This all goes to the whole question of the Three-Fifths Compromise, because the Three-Fifths Compromise gave some representation for purposes of counting to slaves. Of course, the slaves could not vote, so essentially the Three-Fifths Compromise increased the representational power of the slave states. But the Electoral College doesn't do much in that except on the population side, right? And so essentially what you would think that the real, what really the slave states would have wanted was a legislative, vote to elect the president. And in fact, that was on the agenda at the Constitutional Convention. So there was that alternative. So generally, I think it's striking that Weiland's a man who really had every reason politically to think that the Electoral College was a part of slavery, came to change his mind about that. And I would recommend that, you know, people can use your favorite search engine and Weiland's, W-I-L-E-N-T-Z, and Slavery Constitution, and you'll find that op-ed, and you'll make up your own mind. Read it and see what he says about that, and read his book, too.
One of the other claims that is frequently made about the Electoral College is that it gives too much representation, relatively speaking, to rural states, mm-hmm. where extremely populous states don't count for as much as they might under a system of a straight popular vote for the United States.
Yes, and that was part of the design, of course, that there was a desire to have popular representation balanced in some degree by the states as states. So, of course, in the Constitution, the states each have the same votes, two votes in the Senate, and those two votes in the Senate translate into electoral votes. Your electoral votes are a state, are their House representation plus their Senate representation. And, you know, that was, I think that was in general a small state concern or at the beginning. There was a concern, you know, one of the big things about the original convention is there's a real concern about creating a strong central government. And added to that among the small states was that they would be dominated by large populous states like Virginia and Maryland in the ensuing government. So there is that. And what has happened over time because of economic development and others is you do have a movement towards cities. So some of the small states are fairly rural, but that's the nature of the case, right? In the sense of it's a function of the development. Now, the thing I would say about it is when I first looked at this, I looked at the differences that are created, and the weighting of votes is actually quite significant. This is something that California complains about with regard to Wyoming or the District of Columbia. But the actual differences, still you have 57 votes. From the, you know, have a large delegation from California. Then you have two Senate votes from both California and Wyoming. My point being that the actual difference is not all that great. It sort of tapers off the effect of population. But it's not as if population is in a serious way impeded. There is an equality element of states in it, but it's still by and large a popular system. The reason you don't get majority, it's not supposed to reject the national popular vote, but there's other reasons why it doesn't. And I don't think the arithmetic itself is that big a deal. It's other things that have changed over time that make the
Well, I think that the biggest claim that I hear that is intuitively very attractive and yet, as you note, not a part of the design is that if a candidate wins the popular vote and then does not win the Electoral College, that itself is the problem. That because we are hewing too far from the popular will of a simple majority.
Right. And simple majorities have other advantages. I mean, they're unlikely to produce ties or unlikely to not produce a winner, which could happen and has happened once and almost happened and took a long time in 2000. Yes, that's true. Now, remember, the odd thing about all of this is prior to and then even after the 2000 election, which was the first divergence between electoral college majority and a popular majority in a long time, in 124 years, and even longer, actually, because the 1876 election was so strange. And so at the time, Gary King at Harvard, a really sophisticated an analyst did the statistical analysis and projected that this would happen about once a century. And so it really wasn't something that was dominant about it. It would happen now and then, and you had to consider the cost and benefits, that kind of stuff. And then it happened again 16 years later. What has happened is, again, this kind of system is going to be very responsive to changes outside itself. And the changes is, to put it bluntly, is the Democratic voters are too tightly packed together. So they waste a lot of votes. Hillary Clinton won a 3 million popular vote victory in 2016. She won California by 3 million votes. If she had won it by 50,000 or 100,000 votes, she would have gotten the same number of electoral college. So the Democratic voters tend to be to live close together. And indeed, there is a big sort going on in the United States, so that, sorting by party and ideology. And the result is that you can fairly easily, particularly if you, and third-party candidates probably have something to do with it, it can happen. I don't think it's going to happen this year, but who knows, right? And it could have. The other thing about it, of course, is that I'll say two things. One is it's problematic because it seems to come to the advantage of one party and not the other party. If it, both parties either won from it or lost from it, you might have an opening for changing it. But a constitutional amendment that would be opposed by one party because the electoral system benefited them can be stopped. I mean, you can't really, it's very hard. And in fact, I've just assumed for the last 10 years or so that absent some disaster, that there's not going to be any constitutional amendment to change the Electoral College. The Republicans see it as in their benefit. They have certain views I don't agree with about its effects, but they certainly aren't going to change it, I don't think. So it's, you know, it's a system that looks a lot like it just, like everything else, it's been sucked down into the polarization and partisanship of our country. And so you even get what I think are highly dangerous, non-constitutional ways of trying to get to a national popular vote, like the national popular vote interstate compact, which I think is an indication of the frustration in some ways of not having a constitutional amendment. And yet it seems to be quite fragile and probably not something you want to undertake with a highly polarized country. I mean, it just seems like something. Things may go wrong anyway, but you have this situation where a highly polarized country and the presidential election misfires in a serious way, and you have fight. That's 1876. You have fights over state delegations, and it determines the outcome. That just is not something that a chance that we ought to be taking. We've got enough risk, I think.
In 2016, I spoke with Senator Mike Lee of mm-hmm. Utah, and this was maybe a few weeks before the election. And I asked him point blank, you know, is there anything that prevents an elector from going rogue and choosing someone based on conscience rather than the dictate of the state legislature? And he said, nothing at all. And since then, the Supreme Court has said, yes, states, you may, in fact, punish electors for, quote unquote, going rogue. We also have, as you mentioned, this compact in which states would assign their electors based upon whatever ends up being the national popular vote. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the big one, the elephant in the room, in my view, is that the Constitution doesn't give anyone the right to vote on for president. It gives the state legislatures the power to determine where those electors go. And it's only by tradition that states have opted to delegate that to voters. And so it seems like the Electoral College, when created, may not fit well within the institutions as they have developed today.
That's a very good insight that most people have no idea about, right? So this is clearly, first of all, it's important to recall that the heart, in some ways, the hardest thing that the convention dealt with, the most difficult issue, the one they couldn't resolve, was how to elect the president. So you have several votes throughout the summer without much in the way of resolution and no way forward. And you finally get a compromise, which is what we have, between state and popular power. The major alternatives were popular vote, election by the legislature, and then you ended up with this. The election by the legislature is rejected on separation of powers grounds. Popular vote is, some people are against it because they think the masses shouldn't be voting. Some people are against it on the odd to us idea that there couldn't be a national candidate. People wouldn't develop after Washington left. Remember, they had to think about that. They knew Washington would be there for 8 years or whatever. So you ended up with this and a very compromise. And it's also one that didn't take into account, like, the entire Constitution, political parties. The upshot of all of it is, by 1840, you really are starting to converge on one way. The Constitution says the actual system is state legislatures get a certain number of electors. They can decide how to allocate them. They could do it with coin tosses. And as you correctly point out, which is, there is no right to vote in the U.S. Constitution because state legislatures don't have to take account of votes at all, right, in allocating the electors. So they can do it pretty much any way they want to. There doesn't seem to be any internal constraints. But in fact, that's not true. What has actually happened is they allocated in one way, which, except for two states, Nebraska and Maine, now. And the one way since roughly 1840 is winner take all. So that's the Hillary Clinton point about California. 100,000 and 3 million make no difference. She got all of the votes anyway, all the electoral votes. And, you know, notice the all the states could choose to allocate electors according to the popular vote. They all could do that. The states have that power. The parties that run the states, both parties agree that they don't want to do that, though, and they don't do it in 48 out of 50 cases. And even in those cases, it's a modified system of allocating winner-take-all. So this, and the winner-take-all is what really, in other words, I live in California now, and I lived in D.C. permanently, and there's no reason to vote because I can't possibly affect the outcome. I know what I vote or don't vote or who I vote for actually doesn't actually matter because of that.
I am in Kentucky, and that is also true.
Well, as late, though, and this is an interesting point for the whole system, which is, I guess, Clinton won Kentucky probably in 96 was the last time.
That's right.
92, twice.
92 and 96. He won both times.
Well, notice, you know, Jimmy Carter probably won Kentucky, too. The demise of the Southern Democrat in the elite party ranks is an indication of that. And Kentucky's become much, much more conservative than Republican during your lifetime, actually.
So are there practical reasons, especially given controversy surrounding elections? I'm thinking of 2000 when Florida, the issue there was that it was so close, that the Electoral College, as a practical constraint, effectively made that a Florida-only issue rather than sparking fights over the election outcomes in major cities and other areas where it might have had an impact ultimately on who won the presidency. But I can also imagine that the Electoral College itself introduces problems by its existence with respect to getting a clear, credible election outcome.
That's correct, in the sense that, well, you saw that in 2000. And you're right, it did constrain the kind of area of conflict. There's no doubt about that. But it was also the marginal delegation, right? It decided the election by 500 votes or whatever. So it was constrained to that one state, but it was the nature of it. The national popular vote response can be, you know, you're not going to be in that situation with a national popular vote. You might have a very close election, But you're not going to be in that situation because you're not going to come very close to a tie. I mean, Gore and Bush was about 500,000, which is a pretty close election. But it was, you know, you're going to have to end up arguing, in which people may argue, that there's a bunch of fraud in the system and that it reaches that. But it's going to be hard for it to misfire in that way. I do think there, the state element is one that's often cited. There's some truth to it. It maintains a state role in the system, and we've become a much more nationalized, centralized government. I do think if you had a national popular vote, one of the possible disadvantages would be that you end up with a national election commission rather than the Florida Election Commission, the Florida Secretary of State, and 50 Secretary of States and commissions deciding these things. You end up with someone that's similar to a Secretary of State for the entire country. It just seems inevitable because there's a federal election, and it'll be carried out at the state level for sure, but the overall rulings about it and the regulatory apparatus will be in Washington. The reason I think that's a big disadvantage is that's like, you know, it does open the possibility of, in a close election, of fighting over the election commission and how you count the votes nationwide. It does really, I think, increase the probability of tyranny, although, of course, it doesn't, or a overturning of a Republican system. It increases it. Of course, it doesn't guarantee it. It just makes it somewhat more likely because you centralize power in Washington over how you count the votes. You see what I mean? It sounds a little paranoid, but it's not. I'm not saying it would happen. I'm just saying it's a disadvantage of centralizing power that way.
What of the notion that under a different system of parties, that we might end up with candidates who get an electoral vote here, an electoral vote there? Nobody gets to 270, and we are permanently in a position of having the U.S. House and or the Senate select the president.
Well, people argue that about the convention, that actually the system itself is not a rejection of legislative control. It's a mixture, because if they expected that most of the time, or fairly frequently, that the election would be thrown into the House, then you have the legislature electing the president. Issues of separation of powers and corruption, maybe, aren't, that is, that the president does all sorts of things to keep power by making legislators happy. The fact is that, you know, you end up with the legislature making the decision, and maybe they foresaw that. And now it seems as an extreme issue. I think this year, there's arguments, but I've seen arguments that they vote by state. So that's the other part of it in the House, is the significance and centrality of the state is reinforced. It's not a popular election. You don't vote by membership. Every member doesn't have a vote. So right now, I think probably it's a 28-22 Republican advantage. So probably if it goes to the House, Donald Trump's going to be reelected. There's reasons to think it won't go to the House, actually, but that's part of the system. And it also, you know, it could be, it depends on state delegations, and it depends on the distribution of the population, how it actually works out. We haven't gotten into that. Richard Posner argued that the reason to do Florida the way it was done in 2000 was just you were going to end up with a Republican president if you went to the House. So for efficiency reasons, you just cut it short because it, sort of the conflict was, might get out of hand. You keep things out of the House for those kinds of reasons. It probably wouldn't work very well. And it might diverge quite a bit from the popular vote. You know, I will say one thing about the popular vote is it really depends on what people think about it. If they think that this divergence between the, you know, an electoral college winner and a popular vote winner is a bad thing that makes it really undermines Republican government in the United States, then it's a problem, right? It's not obvious that that's a problem, that people worry about it. It could be that it just sort of over time, most people think that. Now, the problem is, this is another issue of the partisanship and the partisan kind of valence of the Electoral College, which is that people are likely to think along partisan lines to the extent that they consider the matter. So they're going to think that it's not a big deal if they're a Republican that you don't get a popular vote winner, and the opposite if you're a Democrat. So we're not, we need people to step back a little bit. We don't have that to assess those kinds of things.
John Samples is a vice president at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.